You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a new U.S. Supreme Court decision allows states to lock in their electors in presidential balloting. We'll find out what the decision means for efforts to reform the Electoral College. Now, the Trump administration is ordering hospitals to bypass the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention when reporting data on COVID-19. The guidance was issued by the Department of Health and Human Services, which says it will be collecting that information starting today. The department oversees the CDC, which had been receiving the data from hospitals through its National Healthcare Safety Network. The move has some public health experts worried about the transparency of data and how it will be used to distribute things like medical supplies and financial assistance. Julie Rovner is the chief Washington correspondent for Kaiser Health News and host of Kaiser's What the Health podcast. Julie, good to have you back with us.
Nice to be here.
What do we know about how and why this change came about?
Well, we know that it came about. We don't know a whole lot about how or why. Obviously, the CDC has been the repository of, you know, this type of medical information for decades through Republican and Democratic administrations. That's where the expertise in the government is. That's why we have a CDC. Now, you know, the White House officials and officials higher up at the Department of Health and Human Services are saying it's not that big a deal, and CDC will be part of how this data is used. But certainly it set off a lot of alarm bells among former CDC officials and a lot of public health professionals that the CDC, it looks, you know, from the outside like the CDC is being cut out of this to some extent.
Yeah, this could look like just a bureaucratic shuffle here. It goes to a different level of the hierarchy. No big deal. Can you talk some more about the concerns raised by, as you said, former CDC officials and other public health experts?
Well, there have been, you know, rules that requiring hospitals and public health agencies to report to the CDC, you know, practically since there's been a CDC. I mean, the CDC has always been the repository of information, particularly about things like infectious diseases. That's literally what they are there to do. Obviously, it's data mostly about hospitalization, but it's about hospitalization of people with COVID-19, an infectious disease. And basically, the CDC makes its data available to outside agencies, researchers, other bodies that do their own number crunching. That's, in fact, almost everybody that's modeling about coronavirus and COVID-19 and how it is spreading is using, you know, as their base numbers, the CDC data.
As I understand it, there had been some concern about the system the CDC was using being a little clunky, especially if you wanted up-to-date, day-to-day data. Hospitals had complained, I think, about, you know, changing guidelines. There were parts of the system that it sounds like not everyone was happy with.
Yeah, well, this has been difficult, and things did not happen very quickly, and a lot of power got sort of centralized in the White House task force, which is, again, pretty opaque. They would come out and, you know, and sort of tell us things, but not necessarily the things that experts sort of said they needed to know in order to figure out how things are going. So, yeah, the federal government's response to this has been kind of all over the place.
Odd thing that came out of this in a letter to state governors, Dr. Birx and Health and Human Services Secretary Alex Azar said they would consider using the National Guard to collect this data at hospitals. What's been the response to that idea?
Yeah, nobody's very excited about that. That they would try to do.
We are talking about the CDC and the Department of Health and Human Services. New guidelines say hospitals send your COVID-19 data to HHS, not to the CDC, which is what's typically done, which is what has been done to this point. Julie Rovner is with us from Kaiser Health News. Now, this comes, Julie, as we have this letter, this kind of open letter, an article by four, I believe, former CDC directors from Republican and Democratic administrations raising concerns, they say, about the politicization of the COVID-19 response. What kind of things did they have to say?
Yeah, this is a big concern, and this has been a concern really all along, you know, particularly as the president and some sort of, you know, non-health officials in the administration have tried to sort of either play down or play up sort of things that there's no scientific, you know, evidence for, like hydroxychloroquine, and there's the public health community is very concerned that the public is getting, you know, very inconsistent advice and recommendations, and they're, you know, the states have been effectively left on their own to try to figure out what to do, and it's been really difficult from a public health standpoint to actually, you know, make recommendations based on science. And obviously we've seen, you know, all week this sort of on again, off again, you know, war on Tony Fauci, who's been sort of the preeminent public health official for several generations now, suggesting that, you know, he gave conflicting advice. But what he did was he modified his advice based on new information about the virus. And that doesn't sort of seem to be what's happening from the White House.
Let's bring on a caller now. Tom is on the line in Madison. Tom, hello.
Good afternoon. There's no doubt in my mind that the principals of the American Hospital Association, any academic hospital association, and any private hospital association need to stand up and say, we will not comply. We regard this as an unlawful order, and Trump and his people can go and stuff it.
Tom, thanks for the call. Has there been any response like that, Julie, from hospitals saying, yeah, we're going to keep giving data to the CDC as Tom would like to see them do?
I haven't seen that, but certainly there's been a fairly immediate outcry all week, really, about from the public health and the medical community about concerns about politicizing what's basically a national crisis. You know, we need information. The federal government needs information to figure out how to distribute supplies and things like, you know, doses of remdesivir, the one drug that can do some help for people with COVID-19. And there's worries that this is not happening according to science, but it's happening according to politics.
Thanks for that call, Tom. Julie, is there a sense that from the federal government, there is a comprehensive plan months into this pandemic now to deal with it?
There really isn't. And I think that's what people are, you know, coming in the public health community are coming to the realization that the kind of leadership we would normally get from the administration, which would normally be led by the CDC, and I've been doing this for 30 years, and in every public health crisis, the CDC has had so many, you know, media availabilities every day that you get tired of them. I mean, that they've always been right there, you know, leading the administration's response, and we have not seen that this time. And we've seen many, many conflicting signals from different parts of the federal government.
And at some points over the course of this, the president and others have said, well, it's up to the states to take the lead. Has that been a norm in past crises?
No, it has not. The federal government has, in this sort of, in something for a contagious disease that crosses borders, the federal government has always been the leader. I mean, often they give states, you know, not every state is impacted the same way, and it's obviously a partnership, but we've never seen this sort of leave it all to the states type of thing before.
Julie, in our last 30 seconds or so, what do you have your eye on next as this story just keeps going?
Well, I mean, I think the big issue now, obviously, is schools and what's going to happen in the fall. But also, one thing we're looking at, we're doing better in terms of testing. There are a lot more tests, but there's not a lot more processing of those tests so that the results are starting to lag. And I think that's going to be a big problem going forward.
Julie, thanks, as always, for joining us today.
Sure thing.
Julie Rovner is the chief Washington correspondent for Kaiser Health News and host of Kaiser's What the Health podcast. She talked with us today about federal guidance that hospitals should report data on COVID-19 directly to the Department of Health and Human Services, not the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, which had been the norm up until now. Coming up, a Columbus High School student helped make a big change in her community, bringing down a controversial statue. She'll tell us her story coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we hear from the high school student who started a petition to bring down a statue of Christopher Columbus in Columbus, Wisconsin. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Carl Christensen with a story about a person bringing the community together by building boats.
Birch bark canoes take a long time to make, but master artist Wayne Vallier from the Lac du Flambeau Band of Lake Superior, Chippewa, tells us that the process is just as important as the finished project. And he should know. Vallier was just selected to be a National Heritage Fellow by the National Endowment of the Arts, one of the top honors in folk and traditional art. Mackenzie Martin with WXPR in Rhinelander brings us the story. It's part of their Curious North series.
Mm-hmm. In early August, master artist Wayne Valier started working with apprentices in Lac des Flambeaux to build a birch bark canoe.
Hello, we're back. We're still in Wayne's garage.
Throughout the canoe's construction, the process was live-streamed on the Waswaganing Indian Bull Facebook page.
And they're working on the ribs to go on the inside of the canoe, so let me turn this around.
The project was part of a larger grant from the First Nations Development Institute.
Wayne Valier, master canoe builder, teaching us how to do this.
All right, let's push another one, right here.
My name is Wayne Valier. My native name is Good Sky. As far as Ojibwe canoe builders, there are only five master builders left in the Midwest.
And two of the five master Ojibwe canoe builders left happen to be in Lac des Flambeaux. It's Wayne and his brother Leon.
On this, pushing this down here.
Wayne Valier has now made over 30 canoes in different communities, and he thinks something that's really important about this work is the way it's able to connect people from different areas.
That connection of the high-end canoe is one that the Anishinaabe brought from the eastern seaboard. It connects the Ottawas, the Potawatomis, and the Ojibwes together.
What does it mean to still be doing this work and to not only be doing this work, but to be training a younger generation on how to do this?
It makes me feel close to my ancestors. It's a responsibility of the older artists of my age to do this for the next generation so that our culture lives on. By knowing where you've been, you'll have a better understanding and where you're going.
Valier believes that the more people they include in the building of the canoe, the more experiences they have represented in the canoe.
We tried to have as many different hands touching these canoes as possible. What happens is people imprint part of their life essence in these canoes. They put a few stitches in. That few stitches stays there for a long time. It becomes very powerful. So at the end of all of that, all the sweat and the life that's happening around these canoes, something very beautiful comes out of it.
He says you can think of the entire process as a reminder of the benefits of teamwork. Like, by itself, the birch bark is weak, the spruce root that ties the whole thing together is fragile, and the pitch that seals the canoe is easily manipulated.
But when you put all of these things together and they work in sync, the canoe becomes very strong, so strong that a person could take a hammer and beat on the side of one of these canoes and you're not going to pierce a hole in it. The teaching is when we stand alone, we are weak, but when we stand together, we're very strong.
Another takeaway, creating something strong takes time.
WXPR's Mackenzie Martin brought us that story as part of their Curious North series. It's a lot like WPR's Wisconsin project, where we answer audience questions in Wisconsin Life segments. To submit your question, go to wpr.org/Wisconsin. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Carl Christensen.
Now, the City Council of Columbus, Wisconsin, voted last week to bring down a statue of the city's namesake, Christopher Columbus. The 4-1 vote came amid debates and protests going on nationally around racial justice, treatment of black people by police, and whether statues of Confederate leaders and other controversial figures should stay or go. While protesters in some cases have taken matters into their own hands and toppled statues themselves, Columbus High School student Abby Adams took a more formal approach. She started a change.org petition and then took her case to the city council. Central Time executive producer Judith Sears-Poisson talked to Adams, who will be a senior this fall.
So why did you feel so strongly about this particular issue?
I mean, I think that I've always kind of cared about it, I guess. I think that when we kind of switched from learning about Columbus in school, from learning that he was a really heroic explorer to somebody who, like, actually, you know, enslaved a lot of people and, like, killed a lot of Native Americans, I think it always really confused me as to why we had that statue up. And I thought that, like, with what's happening, like, right now, especially, like, with racial justice within the United States, I thought that now more than ever, we should be, like, sending that message and taking that statue down.
So you're a high school student, and it can be a little intimidating for someone of any age to take on something quite this big. How did you go from caring about the issue and thinking that something should be done to actually starting the petition on change.org?
I think a lot of it was I had a lot of support when I originally, like, thought of the idea. I texted a lot of my friends, and a lot of them were, like, completely on board. They thought what I was doing was great. And Mary Arnold, who's the chair of the Democratic Party, I shared my idea with her, and she supported me as well and thought that my issue was, like, a very valid thing and would be, like, something that the community would probably support. And so with all that, I was like, why not? If nobody else does it, nothing's going to happen. So
you started the petition. How did you get word out other than, you know, letting people close to you know? But how else did you let the larger community know what you were doing?
So I went on Facebook, and our city has two chatter pages where you can share, like, what's going on in our community. And I shared basically what I was doing on there. And from that, it spread like wildfire because people have very strong opinions about the issue. And so I think most of our city has probably seen it at this point because of people seeing it on Facebook and then sharing it to everybody. And that was pretty much how it blew up.
You also spoke at a city council meeting. I'm guessing that would be a little nerve-wracking. What was that like?
Oh, gosh. I am not the greatest public speaker. I always have a lot of things that I want to say, but when I get up there, I just freeze up a little bit. So it was a little intimidating, but I knew that everyone on the council was really looking to just listen to me and to be supportive. And I knew that there was a lot of people there that very strongly disliked me, but I think that being able to, like, you know, say my piece, try to say, like, what's wrong about what they were saying and, like, how I have a valid opinion was kind of important. So that was a really good learning experience for me, I think, because I learned how to, like, you know, be able to speak in that sort of setting without, like, being terrified of everybody.
And you also chose your words, I think, very carefully, because you included the phrase, "It was never my intention to erase our history." Why was that an important point to make for you?
I think that a lot of people in our community think that what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to say that Christopher Columbus never explored the Americas. He never, like, made a pretty big impact upon our history. And that was not at all what I was trying to do. I think I was trying to explain that Christopher Columbus was not a good person. And I think a lot of members of my community were not taught that. And a lot of people saw me saying, hey, we have new information. He owned slaves. He, like, you know, was not a good person. And they saw that as me trying to rewrite our history and be a social justice warrior and, like, you know, be very, like, PC. And I think that was not my intention at all. I was trying to, like, you know, have that as, like, a discussion or a teaching moment for a lot of people.
We're talking with Abby Adams right now. She's a student at Columbus High School, where she will be a senior in this upcoming school year. She led the petition drive to have a statue of Christopher Columbus taken down in the city. And Abby, you testified in front of the city council, and then there was a vote last week. What happened?
So after a lot of discussion, they finally decided, they voted 4-1 to take the statue down. And I think they're going to decide at a later date where it can, like, have a permanent home with that, like, educational, like, setting where it can have that full historical context.
How did you feel when they took that vote?
I mean, I feel like the city council really listened to us. And I think there was a lot of, people calling for a referendum. And I think that the decision that they made to not go to a referendum was honestly really, really inspiring to see, because they were listening to the people and they were taking action instead of drawing it out into a long process in which nothing would ever be done. And I think especially with all of the controversy and all of, like, the news coverage of this issue, I think that was a really, like, difficult decision for some of them. And I know that a lot of them have a lot of pressure on them now to, like, vote a certain way or, like, do stuff like that. And I think that that was a really good decision on the city council's part.
So you were successful with your petition and your appeal to take down the Columbus statue. It's going to go into storage. You're living in a city named Columbus. You're going to a high school named Columbus High School.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts on that name being associated with those parts of your community?
I mean, I know for a fact that our city was named after Christopher Columbus. I think it was Ludington and Dickinson who decided that. I don't enjoy living in a city named after him. I think that, you know, maybe one day it'll change, but I think that might be a really difficult thing to go about starting because there are so many businesses that, like, have that attached to them. And honestly, I think that when you hear the name Columbus when referring to our town, I think it has a different meaning. I think that when we call our city Columbus, I don't think that we're thinking of Christopher Columbus. I think we're thinking of how strong our community is.
And Abby, what advice would you give to other young people who might see things in their towns or cities that they think needs to be changed and want to be part of that change?
I think that, you know, the first step is to, like, do something. And I think I was a little bit intimidated at first because I honestly didn't think that any members of my community would listen to me or any, like, actual action would be taken. I just thought that, you know, this is the thing that I can do so that I can, like, say that I did it and at least tried. I think you just got to do it.
Well, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
That was Columbus High School student Abby Adams. She talked with our executive producer, Judith Sears-Poisson, about her successful petition to remove her city's statue of Christopher Columbus. Coming up, we'll get the details about a U.S. Supreme Court ruling that allows states to require members of the Electoral College to vote for the candidate they were sent to vote for. And we'll look at the existence of the Electoral College as well, why it's there, and calls to change it or effectively override it in favor of a national popular vote for president. You can join in with your thoughts on those topics over at the Ideas Network Facebook page. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 6 on The Morning Show, it's everything you ever wanted to know about composting but were afraid to ask. Kate Archer-Kent talks to a Wisconsin composting expert who can help you turn your food trash into garden treasure. Tomorrow morning at 6 here on the Ideas Network. Now, the U.S. Supreme Court weighed in on the Electoral College system last week. In a unanimous ruling, the court decided states are allowed to require members of the Electoral College to vote for the candidates they had pledged to support. That would stop electors from many states from being so-called faithless electors. A handful of electors cast votes for candidates other than Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton back in 2016. Barry Burden is a political science professor at UW-Madison. He's also director of the Elections Research Center. Barry, welcome back to Central Time.
Good afternoon.
Well, tell us a little more about what this ruling from the U.S. Supreme Court actually means.
Well, the ruling dealt with two cases, one from Washington State and one from Colorado, that had different conclusions. So the court wanted to solve this problem and reconcile the cases before we get too close to the November election. Their ruling, which, as you said, was unanimous, gave state legislatures the right to bind electors so that they must follow the popular vote. Legislatures are given the power to determine electors really any way they want by the U.S. Constitution. About two-thirds of them decide that the popular vote is the guiding factor, and the justices have said that's just fine. But of course, the states are not required to do that, and there are, I think, 19 states that don't have those kinds of rules in place.
So without this kind of rule, an elector, once they show up vote at the Electoral College, could theoretically be a free agent. And as I mentioned, we saw a few of those, some Hillary Clinton voters voted for Bernie Sanders or others. I think some Donald Trump electors voted for Colin Powell, if I'm remembering correctly, some combination of that. This means that it would be harder for electors in those states that have those guidelines to do something like that.
That's right. It doesn't happen very often, especially after the, say, 1800s. But there are these stray cases where electors go rogue, and that's what produced these two cases that went to the Supreme Court. But as I mentioned, there are still a number of states that would allow electors to go rogue because they don't have a law in place or a penalty that would require them to follow the popular vote. And, you know, some of the founders, Hamilton and Madison and some of the others who wrote the Federalist Papers, might think that's a good thing. They wanted the Electoral College to have some independence, to not be made of politicians and to not be made of regular people or to be guided solely by public opinion or by popular votes. But the court recognized in its ruling last week that for all intents and purposes, states have effectively decided that the popular vote should be the determining factor. And so if they want to have that be the rule, they can make electors follow it.
Why did we make the move? I mean, I think I get the reasoning, but how did we make the move from the idea that we're electing not a president, but electors who will then elect the president, to the electors being mostly just a formality?
It took a while for that to happen. I think this may be surprising to people who assume it's always been like this, but in the early days of the United States, the assumption was that the Electoral College would be quite independent, and the electors might actually be chosen on a district-by-district basis, rather than on a winner-take-all statewide basis. It wasn't really until the mid-1800s that the states began to adopt the popular vote as the way to determine how their electors would be sent to the state capitol in December to vote. And it was really, I think, the late 1800s when the final state decided to adopt that. And now every state but Maine and Nebraska use the popular vote and use winner-take-all to determine their slate of electors. Maine and Nebraska, I think, are nice examples that it's not required of states to do this. Both of those states allocate the electors by congressional district and then have two statewide electors to the winner of the statewide vote. And Maine is actually going to be using ranked choice voting this fall, plus this district-based system to choose its electors. So there is a lot of room for experimentation in the states. They've just chosen, as of 150 years ago or so, to converge on this idea of the popular vote.
We're talking to Barry Burden, political science professor at UW-Madison and director of the Elections Research Center, looking at a U.S. Supreme Court decision on electors saying, yeah, states, you can require your electors to vote for the candidate they were pledged by voters to vote for. They can't, if states require that, they can't go off on their own. Barry, I know some people had a campaign in 2016 trying to get faithless electors to, in effect, thwart the election of Donald Trump. And I think there have been efforts like that in the past. They never seem to go very far. Is there ever a situation in the modern era where faithless electors could actually switch the outcome of a presidential election?
Short answer is no. It doesn't look like maybe there's ever been a case where the faithless electors have actually changed the outcome. They have raised some uncertainty. And, you know, I think Trump had enough of a margin that he could lose a few electors and still be above the 270 mark that's needed to win the Electoral College. But, you know, electors in recent years have been chosen mostly by state political parties, and they are chosen for their loyalty. It's, in many states, a reward for good party behavior. Someone who's been an elected official or maybe an activist, a donor, maybe the chair of the state Republican or Democratic Party, they get selected as electors as kind of an honorary position. So they're proud to do it, and in most cases are enthusiastic about the nominee for their party. So there's little risk that they're going to be rogue and bump up against the party. 2016 was a little different because you had two nominees who weren't beloved by all of the party rank and file. And despite that, there were only about six electors who didn't do exactly what the popular vote told them they should do.
Bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Andrew is with us in Palmyra. Andrew, hi.
Hey, how are you guys doing today?
Good. What'd you want to bring up, Andrew?
So I just wanted to ask the guest a question about when he's referring to the popular vote. Is he talking about the popular vote on a national scale, or is he talking about the popular vote within a state? Everybody in Wisconsin, as far as the majority is concerned, voted for a Republican candidate, but the electors decided to do something else as far as how they decide. Are you talking about the popular vote on the national scale, or are you talking about within the state?
Gotcha, Andrew. And that's a great point of clarification. Barry, what we were talking about at that point was at the state scale, that the electors have to go with the popular vote of Wisconsin or Colorado or whatever the state might be. That said, Barry, some people want to change that to do the other thing that Andrew was pointing toward, have electors have to follow the national popular vote. Can you talk about that movement?
Yeah, it really is worth clarifying these two different levels that we're talking about, the state-based voting and then the national vote. Right now, it's quite possible for the national popular vote to go for one candidate and the electoral college vote to go for another. That happened in 2016. Hillary Clinton won the popular vote by a couple million votes. Donald Trump won the Electoral College. He goes to the White House. It also happened in 2000. So it's happened twice in the last five elections where different candidates won each. The electoral votes right now are allocated state by state, where each state sends a slate of electors for the party that won the most votes in its state. It doesn't have to be a majority, just more than the other side. Trump won more votes than Hillary Clinton in Wisconsin, but it wasn't quite a majority. That didn't matter. You win by one vote or you win by a million, you get all the state's electors. There is a proposal out there that would make the Electoral College follow the national popular vote. It's something called the National Popular Vote Interstate Compact. It's a long name, but it's basically an agreement among the states where they would all sign on and agree to give their Electoral College votes to whoever won the national popular vote, regardless of what happened in their state. If enough states sign on to this agreement, it would have to be enough states that they control at least a majority of the electors, then it would go into effect and could be used for an upcoming presidential election. There are a lot of questions about this compact, whether it's constitutional, whether states would stick to it once they signed on if they didn't like the result. But in theory, if a state like Wisconsin joined the compact, we would give our 10 electoral votes to whoever won the national popular vote, regardless of what happened in our state. And that ought to encourage the candidates to go on a nationwide campaign rather than focusing on 5 or 10 swing states.
We're talking to political scientist and elections expert Barry Burden from UW-Madison about a recent U.S. Supreme Court ruling allowing states to hold faithless electors accountable and about some calls to elect a president via the popular vote, in effect, rather than the Electoral College. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about that? Should electors, once they're picked, should they be free agents allowed to switch their vote if they want to, or should states be able to lock them in? Should presidents be elected by the nationwide popular vote by one mechanism or another? Or do you like the system with electoral votes, even though it may mean that the popular vote winner, as has happened a couple times in recent years, doesn't necessarily get to be president? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about the U.S. Supreme Court ruling that allows states to penalize electors who don't vote for the candidate they pledge to support in presidential elections. Barry Burden is with us, political science professor at UW-Madison, also director of the Elections Research Center. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Do you have a question about this ruling, about the role of electors? Do you want to see a switch one way or another to electing the president via popular vote? Whoever gets the most votes wins the election, or do you like the Electoral College where it is? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Let's go back to your calls now. Tom is with us in Lake Tomahawk. Tom, hello.
Hello. It's been years since I earned my Citizenship in the Nation merit badge in Scouts, and I also didn't get to hear the beginning of this show, so I hope this isn't repetitive. But I have friends who advocate for abolishing the Electoral College and going just with a nationwide popular vote, and I wonder if the speaker could talk about some of the pros and cons for that, of that, especially as it would affect larger, more populous states and less populous states. And I'll take the comments off the air. Thanks
a lot for bringing that up. And we heard from Ellen on Facebook, who says, keep it as it is. It protects us in the flyover states from being run by the elitists on the coasts. And that's a concern we hear often when people talk about national popular vote, that candidates would spend all their time in the places with the most people.
Well, you do hear that. I guess I want to challenge that in a couple of ways. So let's imagine there's a popular vote, and now the winner of the election is the one who gets the most votes nationwide. There would definitely be an incentive to go to large urban areas, places like Chicago and Dallas and Boston, that are right now totally ignored by candidates because they're not in swing states. And it probably would mean that a state like Iowa, which right now gets a lot of attention because it's a swing state, would get less because the population's smaller. And Wisconsin, for that matter, might get less. But I think it's wrong to think that candidates would only go to big cities or that maybe this would advantage Democrats because they do better in cities. After all of our states elect statewide offices like governor. And in those elections, the candidates don't only go to the big cities. We just had a governor's election here in Wisconsin a year and a half ago. And I don't think we would say that Scott Walker and Tony Evers only campaigned in Milwaukee and Madison. They were forced to get all over the state, to run ads in all the media markets, to cultivate different constituencies around the state. And that would be the case in a national popular vote as well. Republicans would want to go to suburbs in Texas, but also the outskirts of Chicago and into parts of even blue states like Massachusetts. There are Republicans everywhere. So it would, I think, change campaigning in a pretty dramatic way. And voters who live in places like California would start to see the candidates, and us in Wisconsin would have a little less time with them and see a somewhat fewer of their ads. You know, right now there's a real inequality because the presidential campaign is fought in 5 or 10 states. And voters in those states get bombarded with activity, and their turnout levels are higher than in states that are the so-called blackout states, where one party is likely to win really easily. And that just seems to violate our idea that candidates ought to be out there trying to win the votes of all the voters.
Thanks for that call. We'll go to Barry now in Rice Lake. Barry, hello.
Yeah, hello. I just was just thinking more about the popular vote statement than that compact. And the flaw in that is every state's got an automatic recount provision, or if there was a close election on the national vote, it would be impossible to do a recount, especially when all the states have different rules and laws and regulations. So that couldn't happen if you had a close election like we have a tendency to have.
Thanks for that call. A close popular vote, national election demanding all states do a recount potentially. Barry Burden, what do you think?
Well, that's a real concern. I appreciate that coming up. There are a few issues that I think complicate a national popular vote. One is that there could be a very close national race that requires a nationwide recount. I think that's highly unlikely because it would mean that the national votes would add up for both parties in such a way that there's essentially a nationwide tie. It's much more likely that would happen in a single state, as was the case in Florida back in 2000, or several states, including Wisconsin, that were very close in 2016. So it's possible, but I think it's very remote as a concern. There are some other worries, like the eligibility for voting varies from one state to another. So in some places, if you've had a criminal conviction, you can never vote again. But in other states, you can actually be in jail or in prison and have the right to vote. So there is going to be some inequality in who's eligible. And if we are going to add up all the votes from all the states, it may be that some states have an incentive to try to make more people eligible to vote to help their side in a partisan way. I don't think that's a terrible thing for the states to have a battle over trying to enfranchise more voters, but it is something to be attentive to. There is one other upside we want to mention, and that is about election security and hacking. Right now, foreign actors have a real incentive to try to infiltrate key swing states like Wisconsin, Florida, North Carolina, because messing with those states in one place could disrupt the whole national system. It's less likely that a foreign actor could do that sort of thing with a national popular vote, because even if they toy with a polling place or a website in North Carolina, it's unlikely to affect the national totals in a significant way. So there are some real trade-offs, but I think the benefits outweigh the costs.
Thanks for that call. Barry, just a few seconds left. A very brief answer. Do you think we'll see a popular vote for president in our lifetime?
I think it's a possibility. Many people won't remember this, but we got very close to doing away with the Electoral College back in 1969 and 1970. The idea actually passed the House of Representatives, was endorsed by President Nixon, and only got hung up in the Senate. So I think there could be a movement in that direction, but it will require people on both sides of the aisle to come together to make that possibility.
Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's political scientist Barry Burden from UW-Madison talking about the recent Supreme Court ruling on the Electoral College process. COVID-19 is like nothing we've seen in more than a century, but the idea that a new virus could threaten the lives of millions around the globe is something public health officials have been thinking about and warning against for decades. As Rob Mentzer reports, some are now seeing their pandemic plans put to the test.
14 years ago, the health officer in Marathon County spent the better part of a year creating a pandemic preparedness plan. Back then, a pandemic didn't seem like something that would actually happen, not even for Julie Willems Van Dyke, who wrote the plan. But she believed in being prepared. So in April of 2006, she gathered with health officials, law enforcement, and local media in Wausau for an exercise. How would they respond if someday there were a real pandemic?
It's a brand new virus.
The media preparedness briefing brought
Wisconsin Public Radio's Glenn Moberg reported on the meeting.
Marathon County's health officer, Julie Willems Van Dyke, said in a pandemic, no one would be safe.
In a pandemic, the germ has mutated or changed, and it's brand new, and no one in the world has immunity to it.
Willems Van Dyke shared some best practices.
Especially before there's vaccine, stay home. The less contact you have with other people, the lower likelihood you're going to come in contact with someone who's sick.
Some of those phrases that I used in 2006, I've used every day since this pandemic erupted.
In 2019, Willems Van Dyke became the Deputy Secretary of Wisconsin's Department of Health Services. There's something surreal, even to her, about the abstract way they discussed a possible pandemic a decade and a half ago. She says the public health advice holds up, but
it's very different in real life than it is when you're doing a tabletop exercise.
Very few people alive today have experienced a pandemic on the scale of COVID-19 before, but it is something many saw coming.
Some of the narrative has been was like, wow, we couldn't really anticipate this. No, I mean, people very much anticipated this.
Jennifer Nuzzo is an epidemiologist at Johns Hopkins University. In September, she was lead author on a report that warned that global health systems were not prepared for a pandemic respiratory virus. That turned out to be true. Nuzzo says it's not just that the federal government didn't anticipate the pandemic. Leaders failed to listen even after the pandemic began, even today.
The case numbers now are higher than they've ever been. So now, and we very much know how challenging this virus is. We have had now multiple months of living with the horrors of this virus, and we're still not acting.
One thing that very few plans contemplated was just how politicized public health measures would become. Brad Karger was Marathon County Administrator in 2006. He was Willems Van Dyke's boss then, and he worked with her on the preparedness plan. Did you consider the political aspects of it?
I have a simple answer to that. No, we had no clue. I think we're naive. You know, nothing like shutting down the economy had ever been tried in our life experience.
In early June, when the disease was declining in Wisconsin, Willems Van Dyke cautioned that the pandemic was not over.
I am haunted by the disease curves I see from the Spanish influenza pandemic of 100 years ago that had a spike in the spring, a quiet summer, and the most deadly spike in the fall.
But the June decline didn't last, and the summer hasn't been quiet. Wisconsin has seen a surge in new cases, setting daily records for new infections. Health officials say we still have a chance to make changes that will slow the spread of the disease, and they hope some changes will be permanent, like better attention to hygiene, social acceptance of mask wearing, and staying home when we get sick. Rob Mentzer, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, a U.S. Supreme Court decision confirmed the sovereignty of tribal lands in a big part of Oklahoma. We'll look at the ruling and what it means for the relationship between federal, state, and tribal governments. A scientist makes the case that academic and scientific organizations need to do more to tackle issues of racism than just issuing public statements about them. And there are a lot of fish in the sea, and they're smarter and more interesting than we might think. A marine biologist joins us for a shoal's eye view of the world's most interesting fish species. All that and look at some of the top news of the day. It's coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent. Tomorrow at 8, after years of debate over charter schools, voucher schools, and more, do we know what works best for kids? An education writer joins the show to tell us what we've learned and what open questions are still out there. That's tomorrow at 8 on The Morning Show. Up next is news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then Wisconsin sports teams, many of them, are getting ready to return to action after being sidelined for the past few months by the coronavirus. We'll get the latest on the Brewers, Bucks, Packers, Badgers, and more. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.